The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll learn about how an increase in research spending over decades has changed NYU.
Suddenly you're able to recruit the kind of faculty who maybe wouldn't have come to the university before, or attract a different caliber of students.
And we'll speak with an international scholar in the area of therapy dogs in classrooms. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The National Science Foundation publishes an annual survey on higher education research and development. The survey offers a glimpse into how colleges and universities are investing in academic research. NYU has been climbing the ranks. The private institution's research spending was more than $1.4 billion in fiscal year 2023, a more than 14% increase from 2022. And three times what NYU spent a decade ago. NYU ranks 12th nationally for research spending, is number 5 among private universities in the U.S., and for the first time is number 1 in the state of New York. To learn more about the impacts, I spoke with Dr. Stacy Bloom, NYU Chief Research Officer, Vice Provost, and Vice Chancellor for Global Research and Innovation.
NYU, at least for the time that I've been there, which has now been 15 years, has been categorized as an R1 research university. So this is the highest level of research activity that you can have at a university. And we've been operating in this category really for as long as I've known. But I would say over the past 10 years, we've seen extremely swift growth in our research enterprise. And that has been due to a really strategic focus on growing that research enterprise.
When the research enterprise is grown, how does that have an effect throughout the institution? You know, when we're not just talking about scientific research, but other areas of research.
Yeah, it's such a good question. So what I mean is taking a central position. So NYU happens to be very, very large, many schools, right? We have a medical school, a dental school, a nursing school, a business school, a law school, a school of the performing arts, a school for social work, College of Global Public Health. We're so, so big. But we hadn't really previously made a concerted effort to centralize a strategic approach to how we're going to grow the research enterprise at the university. So one thing that we've done is moved that effort centrally. And through a pretty directed research development effort, we've been able to foster additional interdisciplinary collaborations, which has helped us grow. But we also have a really good bird's eye view of what's going on at the university, and we can help put resources into very specific areas that we think are high potential for growth and foster the growth within those areas. So some of the interdisciplinary research working groups that we've established that help bring people out of their departments or out of their schools to work at a university level are things like AI, biotech, climate research, cybersecurity, the humanities, quantum research, STEM learning, and strategies to reduce inequality. Those happen to be some high priority and heavy activity research areas for us.
Due to NYU's focus on research and attracting research funding and partnerships with industry, how has that changed the college experience for the average student?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, as we grow our research enterprise, we think a lot about the talent we've been able to attract to the university, because once you're growing your research enterprise, you tend to also grow your rank and your reputation as a research university. And then suddenly you're able to recruit the kind of faculty who maybe wouldn't have come to the university before, or attract a different caliber of students at the undergraduate level, but also master's students and PhDs and even postdoctoral trainees. So there's a real magnet, I think, that starts to be formed when you've got amazing strength in research. You're really able to attract a lot of talent. For us, the fact that we're also in New York City is a big asset, and a lot of people want to come to New York. It's a hotbed for research and for universities and for industry applications. So I think that's the biggest change that we've seen is just the caliber of faculty and the quality of the research that we've been able to produce. It's sort of a self, I don't want to say it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's sort of a, it feeds on itself, because the more research we can do and the higher quality the research, the more funding we can attract. And when we have more funding, we can invest in better research infrastructure and better research space. And so to your question earlier about how have we grown, we've also made those kinds of investments.
Has there been a structural sort of integration with maybe undergraduate classes where more students are taking a lab as part of their science courses, or there is something baked into the curriculum or the academic programs where that investment in research really shines through where it may not have in the past?
Absolutely, right? The growth in research at the university opens the door for so many more people to participate in research projects. And for undergraduates, they really take advantage of this. We have a new undergraduate research program that we've been able to build and to launch. And the more people we can bring into the labs and the research spaces, the more well-trained these graduates will be when they leave our university.
And Dr. Bloom, if you had a crystal ball and you can look into how NYU will continue down its current trajectory when it comes to research, and now is a leader in New York State, the leader in New York State for research funding, is this the winning strategy in your mind? Is an increased focus on research really paying off?
I think for us, it has been. We think a lot about the university 10 years ago. It didn't really have the fundamental foundation upon which to even build a high world-class sort of leading edge research university. So one of the first things that we did was look really hard at the tracks upon which all of our trains have to run. Things that seem simple, research lab safety, human subjects protection program, conflict of interest program, research integrity, responsible conduct for research training, research data management, our sponsored programs office, our ability to enter into contractual agreements with potential partners. We had to build all of that first. And once we had a highly reliable foundation of research operations and research compliance functions, then we can do the research strategy and the research development to build and build and build. And I think we're at a phase now where our ability to have laid those tracks and build that framework now allows us to think really carefully about what do we want to invest in the future so that we can continue on this totally amazing and unprecedented trajectory. So we're one of the fastest growing research universities in the United States. And now we can look forward and say, where are we strongest? What strengths are we going to leverage? How are we going to continue to build? And because we have so much data, we can make really thoughtful choices.
So could you tell
me
about some of the really exciting research that's happening at the university right now?
Sure, I'd be really happy to. I think one thing that makes us unique is that we happen to have research across almost every field and every discipline, from the arts and humanities to the social sciences to the more STEM-focused fields. A couple of things in the past year that have really stood out to me is that at our College of Dentistry, we've established a pain research center, and their focus has been really on understanding how to treat pain, but with a special emphasis on developing alternatives to opioids. So this is really in response to the opioid crisis and the fact that pain management is so highly focused on drugs that are really addictive and cause a lot of issues. So this center also addresses disparities in pain management by incorporating research on social and gender and geographic factors. So that's been one area of focus for us that I think has been really, really special. Another is that New York State, of course, has made really significant investments in semiconductor chip manufacturing and innovation. And New York State has positioned itself as a major hub in the United States now for the semiconductor industry. NYU has secured two grants from the National Science Foundation that are both aimed at advancing chip design education and workforce development, right? So this is such an important part of establishing the state as a center for this kind of work is you need the actual workforce. So one of these grants, it's called BASICS. It stands for Bridge to Application Specific Integrated Circuits, and it offers a 28-week online course that's designed for totally non-STEM folks to participate and learn the fundamentals of chip design. And it culminates in them fabricating their own integrated circuits. So it's really geared towards democratizing access to semiconductor education and enabling diverse professionals to pivot into this field. So we're really excited about it. We've also got another grant also from the National Science Foundation that's more geared towards graduate students from STEM fields, but not from engineering necessarily. So fields like medicine and chemistry, also taking cross-disciplinary courses on designing chips that are tailored to specific applications like gene sequencing.
Well, Dr. Bloom, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Stacy Bloom is Chief Research Officer, Vice Provost, and Vice Chancellor for Global Research and Innovation at NYU. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Therapy dogs are becoming a popular way to support children and adults. Service animals can offer emotional support, companionship, and help people manage their mental health. Dr. Barb Vokatis is an international scholar in the area of dog therapy in schools. The SUNY Oneonta professor also visits classrooms with her certified golden doodle therapy dog, Carmel. Dr. Vokatis is also the author of a new children's book called Carmel Goes to School. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds.
As a parent of an autistic child, a long time ago, my child is going to be 18 in January. But at the beginning in the school, right from the beginning, we had some struggles with academics and just trying to help in providing good services for my child, for my daughter. And I remember at that time thinking that we still in schools do not have capacity and maybe enough help for autistic children, even though there is IEP, which is Individualized Educational Plan, and other services. It's still very hard to make both academics-wise and how autistic children feel in school as far as inclusion feel good about themselves. And I was thinking, like, what else can we do to help with that? And then we got a dog without even thinking about doing pet therapy. But I remember when we eventually started thinking about it, my first thought, without really realizing how many benefits from pet therapy actually exist, I was thinking, how about if we do this and certify my dog as a therapy dog, as a therapy dog team, actually, and see what I can do. I would like to take her to the classroom and see what would happen. Would it be, and now actually my dog is heard on the phone call, perhaps. She's a frequent participant in all kinds of podcast recording, obviously. And I remember that's what I did. It was 6 years ago, actually, 6.5 years ago, which is unbelievable, when we started going together, my dog and myself, to the school and interacting with children. Of course, starting with classrooms whose teachers were more open to trying these kind of activities and who would be willing to welcome me and my dog in the classroom. So that's how it started. It's really hard to make a long story short, but I think I tried.
No, that was perfect. And I'm curious how you would define the term therapy dog.
Therapy dog is a dog who can come to all kinds of places. It can be a school, it can be a medical institution, a hospital or nursing home, and other places, wherever someone, people, children, adults would potentially benefit from the presence of a therapy dog, to be able to pet a therapy dog, whisper something to the therapy dog, interact in different appropriate ways, but not every animal can be a therapy dog. An animal like that should have a certain disposition, as you can imagine, should be able to allow others to pet her, to touch her. That is very, very important. And usually in order to qualify to be a therapy dog, there are some trainings and certification that is required to receive this title. And we have all kinds of therapy dog organizations, and many of them are quite reputable that give, so to speak, certification, a title of this kind.
You have written two books about therapy dogs. One is a children's book titled Carmel Goes to School, which details a day of Carmel going to school to visit a class and the children in it. And you also have another book titled Teachers and Therapy Dog Teams, which to me is kind of an inside look into therapy dogs and definitely is a help book when it comes to this topic as a whole. And in Teachers and Therapy Dog Teams, you and the co-author Lucinda Ormiston, who is a second and fifth grade teacher, take readers through activities children can do with therapy dogs in classrooms. So what are some of those activities and the benefits of them?
We have described in this book activities that we recently engaged in. They are a little bit more creative. My dog is a little bit more like a teacher assistant, and me, myself, I am also a little bit of teacher assistant. So, for instance, we have a very simple activity on kindness in the classroom, in the school. There was a kindness theme, and we connected that theme with my dog. We asked children, tell us how your favorite therapy dog, Carmel, shows that she's a kind dog. And kids, including the shy kids, they all wanted to describe what my dog does to show that she's a kind dog to them, to the teacher. It was just amazing to see. And then we asked them, okay, now what you learned from Carmel about kindness and being kind to each other, how can you be kind to people in your life, like in your family or in the classroom? What did you learn from Carmel that you can use and be kind to others? And we were talking about how dogs are not people, so they will be behaving in a little bit different ways, and people might show kindness in a little bit different ways than animals and dogs. And again, children were so excited about the question, and they were finding all different ways how they can show they are kind to others, to their family, to their friends. And then we asked them to just write about it. Maybe do the picture as well, draw something, maybe draw Carmel. Many of them did that. But write about it. How can you show kindness to others? What did you learn from Carmel? This activity involved all kids, because they all wanted to talk about their therapy dog, even the shy kids, and then involved them in writing. In this particular class, many children did not want to write. Some of them barely would write a word in second grade. That was right after the pandemic. And by connecting to their favorite animal, therapy dog, that comes to the classroom, all kids were very motivated to write something, to write several sentences. Yes, they needed some help with this, but they wanted to get the help. They wanted to write something, more than one word for sure. So the benefits are tremendous, I think, because the benefits are starting with children's well-being. They feel better in the classroom. They feel the dog is their friend, and their friend is there for them, to cheer them, to help them in learning, to make them feel really good in school. And then the dog helps them in learning something, in writing. And there are a lot of other activities in the book. Children ended up writing their own books, actually, which was amazing. And we also provide activities that relate to learning math, which was another success. We had no idea how much children can learn, including children whose math skills are very weak. how they can learn when you engage them in activities that include therapy animal in more creative ways.
Wow. And how do you make sure that dog therapy is successful in classrooms?
I think their number one thing is to find a teacher who would be willing to do this, who would be willing to welcome therapy dog. And then therapy dog team, they are visitors. So they are not the ones who say, how are we going to do dog therapy? As you can imagine, they need to really interact and collaborate with the teacher and ask. That's what I did when we originally, 6.5 years ago, started the visit. I asked the teacher, how would you see it happen? My dog is this kind of dog. That's her personality. We can do this. We can do that. How would you see it happen? So I'm listening to the teacher. We try. And then we see from there if we could modify it, do a different activity or not. It was actually very simple. We had the whole classroom, the whole class of children, and they were learning math or social studies or science, whatever subject that was. And I would come in with my dog, and we would just walk around the classroom, stop once in a while at each desk. The child would pet Carmel, would even whisper to her, and then just go back to their learning, whatever it is that they were doing. That's how we were doing it, in a very simple way. And actually, in many cases, the teachers said, we just love this way, and we just want to keep this way of interacting. So it's about being receptive and working together with the teacher. This is done in a way that doesn't interrupt learning, but really can even help in it.
And I would love to know if you could tell me some memories of your time in classrooms with your dog, Carmel. I mean, in your children's book, Carmel Goes to School, it kind of takes readers throughout a day of Carmel and helping children in a classroom with their emotions and feelings. So is there maybe something about children's emotional reactions that you can remember, anything of that nature?
Yes, these emotional reactions, they happen every time. Every time we go, we see smiling faces that just brighten up. And that's the first thing you see. So the emotional reactions are just a marker of every visit. And but there are some moments that were very specific and very memorable. We had a situation where one child did not speak in the classroom to the teacher at all. I think he only spoke at home, but never in school. And I didn't know about it, but I remember when the teacher, so this is maybe not so much my moment, but the teacher's moment, she said that, I remember that too, that when Carmel approached this child at once, and she did something funny too, and the child said to her, oh, Carmel, you just came to visit me. This is so funny, and you're so cute. I love you. And he, at this moment, he just started talking for the first time. That was the first time the teacher heard the child. So this was just so amazing. You can only imagine how many, in every school, there's probably several kids of this kind. They do not talk. They do not speak. And only an animal can start something, some kind of breakthrough. So that was just amazing. I just have moments like that all the time when we come with my dog and we hear, I see them petting my dog and saying to her, Carmel, I love you. You came to visit me. That's so awesome. I was waiting for you all week long. Recently in fifth grade, the girls, two girls, they came up to me and said, can we show something to Carmel? And I was, I said to them, of course you can. What is it that you would like to show to Carmel? It was just very intriguing. And they said, we would like to show her our instruments, because they play instruments. One had a saxophone, another had a flute. So can I show Carmel my saxophone? Of course you can. So she was opening the saxophone, like a special briefcase, and showing to my dog. Then another one approaches us. Can I show her my flute? It was really such an incredible moment. And I was surprised a little bit because these are already a little bit older girls in fifth grade, but they wanted to show something to my dog. It was absolutely amazing.
Wow, that's so nice to hear those memories. And my final question to you is, what do you hope for the future of dog therapy in schools, in classrooms?
I hope that this activity will become more common, for sure, because children deserve it. They deserve to feel better in school and in the classroom. I also hope that this activity will be done in responsible, appropriate ways. That's also very important. And I also hope for this activity to be a little bit also more innovative. So while it's still very important to bring a therapy dog and not do really anything specific, they just become a part of the classroom. They can just walk around, or they can sit or lay down and just listen to the child read. They can also play a different role, more like a teacher assistant, more innovative role based on their personality, based on their consent, if they want to participate in certain activity. So there is a lot of potential in this field that can really help in both children's academics and progress across all subjects, really, math, social studies, writing, reading, you name it, and also in their well-being and mental health. And that's what we want to see in school, improvement in these both areas. And that's the activity that can, I think, contribute to both areas.
That's Dr. Barb Vokaitis, a SUNY Oneonta professor and international scholar on therapy dogs in classrooms, speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1788. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.